IB English Radio.
Worldwide rallies mark International Women's Day, with some countries witnessing clashes between marchers and security forces. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry condemns Israel's expansionist policy and plans for annexing a large part of the occupied West Bank. Senegal's released opposition leader Ousmane Sonko warns the country's president against running for office beyond a two-term constitutional limit. It's good to have you. Well, our top story, women have held rallies in many countries to mark the International Women's Day. In some places, like the Algerian capital, scuffles broke out between marchers and security forces. Algerian women were demanding new rights and the departure of the ruling elite. Demonstrators in the Polish capital also clashed with police. The rally in Warsaw took on added significance months after a constitutional court banned almost all abortions. In the Ukrainian capital, Kiev, protesters demanded the authorities ratify laws to combat domestic violence against women. Over 1,000 people also took to the streets of the German capital, Berlin, calling for more gender equality and protection from violence and abuse of women. In Turkish city of Istanbul, protesters gathered in Taksim Square to call on authorities to prevent violence against women and punish the perpetrators. In France, women have taken to the streets to mark the International Women's Day and call for equal rights. They protested in particular against the impact of the COVID-19 crisis on their working conditions. Our correspondent in Paris leads us off.
All over France, demonstrations took place on the 8th of March, the International Women's Day. In hospitals, supermarkets, schools, and nurseries, most of the employees are women. The COVID-related lockdowns and curfews had a huge impact on them. Their working conditions are getting worse. A group of cleaning women working for a huge hotel chain in Paris are in strike for almost 2 years. The COVID does not improve their situation.
Because of the COVID, the boss said he would pay us, but he did not pay us at all. He said, because of the COVID, I cannot pay you. So in fact, the COVID has become a pretext for making profit on the back of the workers. The COVID arrived on a bad moment. I believe it benefits much more to the bosses and not at us, the workers.
According to a 2020 report of INSEE, the French National Institute for Statistics, women in France are paid 23% less than men. In many sectors, such as healthcare, retail, and cleanup, the work had to be maintained during the lockdown. And 8 over 10 employees in these sectors are women.
The COVID led to an overload of work because they have to clean door handles, for example, what they did not have to do before. Housemaids also go from one working place to another, which increases the possibility of contamination. But they continue assuring the work very seriously. We do not understand that their salaries are not increased.
The INSEE report also shows that the sectors where mostly women work were the most requested during the COVID crisis. The employees there had to work much more hours, and they had a high incidence of illnesses directly related to their working conditions.
The working conditions were already catastrophic before the COVID crisis, and it's getting worse. The French policies have not changed. They continue to diminish the number of hospital beds.
And if this was already not enough, it is also proven that the COVID crisis has increased the domestic violence against women.
Many women are fighting in the front line against the COVID pandemic, at work and at home. These protesters are demanding better and direct measures from the French government. Chris Denhant, Paris.
The controversy over France's treatment of its Muslim community is deepening. French Muslims and rights organizations have complained to the European Commission about France's so-called Imam Charter, the brainchild of President Emmanuel Macron, that they say is the epitome of the country's state-sanctioned Islamophobia and an infringement on their freedoms.
A cry for help for France's more than 3 million Muslims. A letter of complaint signed by a global coalition of 25 civil society organizations and NGOs spanning 11 countries to the President of the European Commission, urging immediate action against France for what they call is its state-sponsored Islamophobia. Renamed the Charter of Principles, the Imam Charter's 10 articles set out the so-called Republican values to which all imams in France should subscribe. Either you're with the Republic, the French president has warned, or you're not with the Republic.
What Macron is trying to do is feed into a narrative that Muslims is a cultural threat to France. And really, the reality is that France, the vast majority of French Muslims are law-abiding citizens. They've been arising social, economically in French society, and that is a concern and a threat to the French elite.
The new letter of complaint follows a similar one in January by a coalition of Muslim NGOs to the UN Human Rights Council. The already existing problem of French Islamophobia took a turn for the worse in the wake of the beheading of school teacher Samuel Paty by a Takfiri extremist outside his school in November last year for showing offensive cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad during his class. For the French president, that provided a valuable opportunity. He defended the profane cartoons and introduced legislation targeting so-called Islamic extremism.
So this is entirely cynical. He's using this for political gain. And the reality is, as soon as you start conceding room to the far right, then that normalizes them. So I wouldn't be surprised if he actually loses votes.
The deeply offensive caricatures set off angry protests worldwide. But inside France, a crackdown on the Muslim community. Multiple mosques were forced to close. The country's biggest Muslim charity and an anti-Islamophobia organization were banned. Dozens of people were arrested, and hundreds faced deportation. Critics say the recent moves by the French state target Muslims and alienates them. And the French government's attempt at aligning French Islam with Republican values and to combat separatism raises more questions than answers. Saeed Kouriza, London.
The Palestinian Authority has slammed Israel's plans for constructing new settler units in the occupied West Bank. In a statement, the Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs said the regime is pressing ahead with its expansionist agenda aimed at ethnic cleansing and displacing Palestinians. The statement also denounced what it called Israel's intention for implementing plans to annex parts of the occupied West Bank. In the meantime, the ministry welcomed the International Criminal Court's decision to launch an investigation into war crimes committed by the Israeli regime. The ICC is set to pro-Palestinian deaths during the 2014 Gaza War and the March of Return rallies, as well as Israel's illegal settlement activities. Political commentator Sayed Mohsen Abbas says Israel would violate international laws as long as it enjoys the support of the United States and the West.
The system that's actually currently and has been for the last several decades in charge of American policy remains constant, regardless of whether it's Biden, Trump, and all the other, what I describe as levers of power, puppet leaders. There really is very little difference between either Democrats or Republicans when it comes especially to Israel and the exceptionalism that America has for Israel. Israel can continue to violate international law as and how it likes. America certainly won't do anything about it. Biden, again, in this instance of the ICC criminal investigation, is also continuing to dig his heels in. He is not a party to the ICC. America never has been, nor is Israel. And they are obviously not taking what the ICC do seriously, and they're certainly against the inquiry altogether.
An explosion has rocked the Iraqi capital, Baghdad, leaving at least 8 people injured. Iraqi media say the blast resulted from a grenade that targeted pilgrims heading to the shrine of Imam Musa Kazem, the 7th Shia Imam. Security forces have cordoned off the area, and an investigation has been launched into the incident. There has been no immediate claim of responsibility, however, the Daesh terror group had carried out similar attacks in the past. And the death toll from a series of explosions at a military camp in Equatorial Guinea has risen to 98. Authorities say at least 615 people were also injured in the blasts at the Nkontoma military base in the coastal city of Bata on Sunday. Nearly 300 of the wounded people remained hospitalized. President Teodoro Obiang has attributed the accident to negligence related to the handling of dynamite stored at the camp. So the explosions damaged almost all homes and buildings in Bata. The government has also called on people to donate blood, noting that hospitals in the region are overwhelmed. Senegalese opposition leader Ousmane Sonko, after being freed from detention, has warned President Macky Sall against running for office beyond the allotted two-term constitutional limit.
We demand Macky Sall declare publicly and without ambiguity, this yes-no business is over. A president that neither says yes nor no, where does that lead us? Where is my goodwill? But he should declare publicly and without ambiguity, and the people demanded, that in 2024 he will pack his bags and he will leave, one way or another.
Sonko also called for much larger anti-government protests, but urged his supporters to stay peaceful. President Sall, however, called on people to be calm and avoid confrontation. The country has witnessed days of deadly clashes between opposition supporters and security forces. That after Sonko was detained last week over accusation of rape, igniting mass outrage at the government that led to the worst unrest in the usually tranquil West African nation. Sonko says the case is politically motivated. He was released on bail on Monday pending a rape trial. People have held a rally in the U.S. city of Minneapolis ahead of a trial of an officer involved in the choking death of African-American George Floyd. Black Lives Matter activists demanded justice for the man who died at the hands of Derek Chauvin, a white police officer, in May 2020. Video footage showed Chauvin kneeling on Floyd's neck for 9 minutes while the victim pleading not being able to breathe. The trial was set for Monday but was put off for at least a day after a higher court ordered the judge to consider adding an additional murder charge. The officer is now facing second-degree murder and manslaughter charges. Three other officers at the scene are also facing trial. The death of Floyd sparked a flurry of protests against racial injustice and prompted calls for police reform in the U.S. Colin Campbell says the people are protesting as they want justice and are tired of decades of disproportionate treatment in the U.S.
What you're seeing and what you're witnessing is the frustration and anxiety and somewhat an expression of hopelessness that there will be justice for George Floyd. And that's because of the precedent that has already been set when we have situations where a police officer kills an unarmed black man and also at times black woman, that police officer or those police officers are acquitted and never face any serious penalty for the loss of life. And so these people are protesting because they want to see justice. They're tired of what has been happening for not just the past several years, mind you, but decades, and some would say centuries, when the start of the beginning of slavery in the U.S., and then when there were slave patrols, and there was probably even less accountability then. There weren't any cell phones recording videos of an encounter by a black person with a white person who may have just killed them simply because they were not deferring to them. They weren't obsequious. They weren't in chains. We don't know, but we do know that this historic nature of disproportionate treatment and the ill treatment coming from many members of the white community to the black community in the United States is historic in nature.
The number of confirmed COVID-19 infections in the virus-stricken United States has surpassed 29 million. According to the Johns Hopkins University tally, the U.S. has so far also logged over 525,000 coronavirus deaths. Despite an ongoing mass vaccination program, the U.S. remains the world's worst-hit country by the pandemic. Meanwhile, elsewhere in the Americas, total confirmed cases in Brazil now stand at over 11 million as the country reported 32,000 new infections. The South American nations, which is the world's second worst hit in terms of deaths, also registered 1,000 new deaths, taking the total fatalities to more than 266,000. Despite being scaled back, the U.S.-South Korea joint military exercises have ignited opposition, which argues the drills inflame tension with North Korea and aim to protect the U.S. and its bases in the region rather than South Korea. The command post exercises are set to run until March the 18th, just as high-level U.S. officials are scheduled to arrive for talks. Frank Smith reports.
The U.S. and South Korea began joint command post exercises Monday, which plan to run through March 18th. The controversial drills draw opposition from peace groups in South Korea and around the world. COVID-19 restrictions prevented more people from gathering outside the South Korean presidential office. But they made their point.
We have to pay attention to the U.S. emphasis on fight tonight, which means South Korea and the U.S. military training is to maintain combat readiness. We must think again on this point of combat readiness. What is the purpose of fight tonight? Who is it going to protect?
Activists in Seoul don't think the drills offer South Koreans protection.
We oppose the drill because it's not for the protection of the South Korea, but is illegal training for the protection of the U.S. mainland and U.S. military bases in the Indo-Pacific area.
South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff said the drills would be scaled back, quote, comprehensively taking into consideration the COVID-19 situation, the maintenance of the combat readiness posture, the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, and the establishment of peace. But some experts expect some type of provocation from North Korea in response to the exercises, as Pyongyang views the drills as a rehearsal for invasion. U.S. President Joseph Biden's new administration has said it's reviewing its policy toward North Korea in consultation with its allies. Just as the U.S.-South Korea military exercises are scheduled to wrap up, sources say U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin will arrive here in Seoul for talks with their South Korean counterparts. North Korea policy should figure high on the agenda for those conversations. Frank Smith, Seoul.
China says it plans to speed up efforts to pass a bill aimed at countering external interference in its affairs. Parliament Chief Li Qiangxiu said China will upgrade its legal toolkit to oppose foreign sanctions and long-term jurisdiction. Last November, the Chinese president had called for the use of legal means in matters involving foreign parties and defending the country's sovereignty, security, and interests. China is at loggerheads with the U.S. and its Western allies over a number of issues, including trade, Taiwan, and a new security law in Hong Kong. On Monday, the Chinese foreign ministry warned against any interference in Hong Kong's affairs and expressed Beijing's commitment to supporting the one country, two systems policy toward the financial hub. China passed Hong Kong security law in June last year after months-long anti-government protests in the semi-autonomous city. Beijing says the law aims at tackling terrorism, secession, subversion, and collusion with foreign forces. The U.S. and its allies say the law ends the city's autonomy and civil liberties, an allegation that China firmly rejects. Washington has imposed several rounds of sanctions on Chinese officials over the security law. Well, that's your word news for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Although the world's poorest populations are often least responsible for climate change, they primarily suffer the worst consequences of its effects. From streams drying up to an increasingly insecure food supply, and have the fewest tools and resources to address it. We are prepared for an article written by Mercy Kurunditu, under the heading Social Inequality and Climate Breakdown. The article has appeared on the front page of the ecologist.org website. Please stay with us for more of Mercy Kurunditu's article. Social inequalities are a driver for climate breakdown. These problems and the potential solutions are much in evidence in Kenya. Poor and marginalized communities are the hardest hit and often end up paying the highest price as the world grapples with the effects of climate breakdown. This disparate impact has traditionally received less attention, with conversation for many years focusing primarily on changes to the physical environment. Only recently has the impact on communities come to the fore, with wider society now beginning to recognize the devastating impact of climate change on the people and communities least equipped to respond to it. Although the world's poorest populations are often least responsible for climate change, they primarily suffer the worst consequences of its effects, from streams drying up to an increasingly insecure food supply, and have the fewest tools and resources to address it. Estimates by the United Nations Development Programme, UNDP, indicate that over 100 million people could fall into extreme poverty due to climate change by 2030. while more than 200 million people could be displaced due to more frequent and severe climatic disasters. It is a vicious cycle. Poverty increases communities' vulnerability to the damage caused, with decreasing their ability to cope and recover with this impact, further exacerbating their marginalization and economic instability. How do we break this vicious circle and ensure these populations are not only well equipped to withstand the current effects of climate change, but are also given the tools to thrive on a socio-economic level? One of the simplest ways is through preserving nature at a grassroots level, empowering local communities to protect their environment and build their future resilience. This can be done in many ways, including urban forestry, agroforestry, community-based ecosystem management, integrated mangrove and fisheries farming systems, amongst others. Encouraging communities to plant trees also has a significant impact and proven record of success. This practice protects the soil under smallholder farms from erosion, whilst compost from the fallen leaves improves the quality of the soil, increasing their harvests. These foresters without diplomas, individuals whose lives and livelihoods depend almost entirely on the environment, realize that this simple act of planting trees would not only provide them with food and fuel, but would also protect and restore the land and halt desertification. Improving infrastructure is also crucial. According to the World Resources Institute Climate Analysis Indicators Tool, Kenya's total greenhouse gas emissions in 2013 was 60 million tons of CO2, or 0.13% of world's total, and is projected to grow to 143 metric tons of CO2 by 2030. Kenya's cities and towns are expanding and urbanizing at a breathtaking rate, but they do not have adequate infrastructure to support the needs of the urban populations. A consequence of this is the dumping of untreated waste products in landfills, rivers, and other public sites in the poorest neighborhoods, polluting the air and poisoning the local water supply. In Nakuru, Kisumu, and Mombasa, urban counties in Kenya, the Green Belt movement is increasingly working with local and national partners to curb the emission of greenhouse gas emanating from poorly managed municipal waste. And yet, these garbage dumps, which pollute the air and poison the water, are turning into a source of valuable income for the poor and vulnerable living close by, providing fuel for cooking their food and heating their homes, and rescued materials to sell. Despite these circumstances, we're beginning to change the story on climate change. In Nakuru County, the local community has been encouraging waste prevention and separation at a household level, turning the Giotto dump site into a source of wealth. Through simple recycling techniques, individuals are turning different waste products such as paper, cartons, plastics, and e-waste into ornamental pieces and decorative accessories, including bags. Some 158 kilometers away in Kenya's capital city, Nairobi, dump sites are the primary source of the materials the community uses to make organic compost, with a monthly output of 10 tons. Which they sell to farmers across the country. Nature-based solutions are key to addressing the underlying factors behind environmental degradation and poverty, as well as empowering communities to take charge of their resource management, breaching the social inequality gap, and promoting a circular economy. Collaboration underpins this success, whether it's between the local communities and non-profit organizations, governments and local authorities, or with wider society. We're all responsible for protecting our environment and ensuring everyone is protected from the impact of climate change. The Green Belt Movement was founded in 1977 by Professor Wangari Maathai. The Green Belt Movement's work has focused on conserving the environment by empowering communities, particularly rural women and their families, to restore the environment, promote good governance, develop climate resilience, and build sustainable livelihoods. The Green Belt Movement is proud to be a nominating partner to the Earthshot Prize, a new £50 million global prize for the environment led by a team of leaders from different parts of the world to incentivize change and drive a new wave of impactful solutions across all levels of society. The seeds of equity and environmental stewardship have been planted, but their shoots are still fragile. Unless we nurture them, future generations will inherit a less secure world. Climate change and social inequality are inextricably linked, and we can't solve one without addressing the other.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and congratulations to all on the decisive victory of Islam over the Israelite seditionists at the historic Battle of Khaybar that was won single-handedly by the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Here is what Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, told the Imam while sending him to conquer the impregnable fortress of Khaybar. Invite them to Islam and inform them of their duty towards Allah and Islam. By Allah, if he guides one single soul through you to the right way, it will be better for you than to own a huge treasure.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This man changed the world.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program dedicated to the life and times of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul. And I'm your host on this program, Ijaz Hussain. And the expert I have to discuss this, as usual, on the life and times of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, is Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, good friend, academic scholar, and Islamic scholar as well. A very warm welcome to you, sir. Salam and hello.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, we are looking at the Imam's will.
Mm-hmm.
Give us the analysis, if you like, the thinking behind why is it so essential that we Muslims must be united.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Let's look at what he said in this quote. Unfortunately, in the hands of conniving enemies and ignorant friends, the Holy Quran, this divine book that is empowered to decide man's destiny, has found no place anywhere except in graveyards and at gatherings of the dead, for the dead, although technically also of the dead.
Of the dead, of course, yes.
The instrument that was to unite Muslims and all mankind, the instrument that was to unite Muslims and all mankind.
Yes. And all mankind.
Listen, Imam is... You know, it's his last will. So he's being hardcore.
He's very hardcore.
He's not even...
And because when he says all mankind, of course the Quran is for all humanity, for all time.
Right.
Whether we are believers or not is immaterial.
Right. The instrument that was to unite the Muslims and all mankind and serve as the scripture for their lives and salvation has turned into an instrument of division and dispute among men, or it has left the arena entirely. We all witnessed that whoever spoke of Islamic rule or of politics, which is the major role of Islam and its Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, or of the Quran and the Islamic traditions, was regarded as one who had committed a grave sin. The term ahund siyasi, political clergy, came to denote a profound obscurantist.
Right.
These circumstances still exist. In recent years, major satanic powers have, through their puppet regimes, undertaken to reprint and publish the Holy Quran, distorting sacred verses to serve their devilish ends. Such Qurans are published with attractive calligraphy and binding and are distributed everywhere with the aim of eventually removing the Holy Book from all scenes. We all remember the Quran that Muhammad Reza Khan Pahlavi had printed. He succeeded in deceiving some people, including a few Muslim ahunds or preachers who, unaware of the aims of Islam, praised him for it. We note that each year, King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, at that time it was King Fahd in Saudi Arabia, spends a good deal of wealth of the people in printing the Holy Quran and considerable publicity and propaganda material in support of the anti-Quranic ideas, propagating the baseless and superstitious cult of
Wahhabism.
Fahd abuses the Quran, urges negligent people and nations to side with the superpowers. He uses noble Islam and the Holy Book to destroy both. And let there be no doubt that, I'm saying this now, this is not a quote, that it is exactly the same way today.
Exactly.
With Abdullah.
With Abdullah and Bandar.
And whoever it is that's going to rule the Al-Saud, because Al-Saud look at Islam as an instrument to maintain their family
own
rule.
Power.
They don't really care about Islam.
No, they don't, because they burn the Qurans as well.
Right. We are proud, this is Imam, and I love this part, we are proud, and our dedicated nation is proud, that we adhere to the faith in which the Holy Quran speaks of the unity.
The unity, yes.
The unity of all Muslims and the oneness of mankind.
Oneness of mankind.
Because it's not just about the unity of Muslims, it's the oneness of
mankind.
Mankind. We are proud that our faith has retrieved the Quran from the cemeteries and has saved this holy book as man's prescription for freedom from all physical, mental, and intellectual bonds that push him deeper into slavery and nothingness.
Into non-existence.
We are proud to be followers of a religion whose founder has been designated by divine commandment, and in which Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salam, this servant of God, free of all bonds and shackles of servitude and serfdom, has been appointed to deliver mankind from all the chains of slavery and enslavement. We are honored that the book Nahjul Balagha, which is next to the Quran, is man's great manuscript for salvation, moral and material existence, and the greatest instrument for just rule and government, and has our infallible Imam Ali as its author. Well, you know, what can I say? We see these things. There's other things he says here, which I think is very nice. And I'm reading this in the beginning, and then we're going to talk a little bit more, because I think, you know, his own words really
say it all.
Right. Our nation, indeed all Islamic nations, as well as the meek and oppressed, are pleased to see that their enemies, who are the enemies of Almighty God, of Islam and of the Holy Quran, are indeed savages, who do not desist from committing any criminal acts to promote their mean purposes, and who are unable to tell a friend from a foe in achieving treacherous goals. I think this would
goes down. Reflects Syria very well.
With what's going on in Syria.
Syria, very well.
Okay, now
savages.
Let's listen to the sentence. Yeah. This sentence that's going to come.
And digest that.
And let's just ponder on it. The USA is the foremost enemy of Islam. Period.
What's new?
It is a terrorist state by nature.
And they declared a war on terror, didn't they?
It is a terrorist state by nature that has set fire to everything, everywhere, and its allies. The internet and its allies. Everything, everywhere, and its allies.
Allies as well.
No, no. And its ally, international Zionism, stop short of any crime.
Yes, the Zionist regime.
And its ally, international Zionism, does not stop short of any crime to achieve its base and greedy desires.
Yes.
Crimes that the tongue and the pen are ashamed to utter and write.
True.
The insane idea of a greater Israel urges them to commit any shameful act. The Islamic nations and the mustazafin, the weak and oppressed peoples of the world, are pleased to have Hussein of Jordan, a professional itinerant criminal, Hassan of Morocco, and Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, fellows of Israel, as their enemies. The people are proud to have them as their enemies. These are criminals with Israel. These are co-criminals with Israel, and commit any act of treason against their own nations to serve the USA. We cheer to have Saddam the Aflaki as an enemy, whom friend and foe know to be a criminal, a violator of human rights and international laws, and whose betrayal of the people of Iraq and of the Persian Gulf Emirates has been no less than his betrayal of our country and people. We and the oppressed peoples of the world are delighted to be objects of criminal accusations by the superpowers through their international mass media under their control.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
I mean, think about this, this is
right at the beginning. Well, you know,
I mean, think about all these people these Muslims who so desperately try to please love us.
Yes,
please, we're good.
We are good, we are nice.
Right.
We're peaceful.
He's saying we're proud.
Yeah.
We're delighted.
Yeah.
To be objects.
Objects.
Of criminal accusations.
Exactly, because it keeps us on the right path.
Well, I mean, I think it just you have to understand Islam.
Yes, this is it.
Right.
This is what we're talking about.
What can be a better source of pride? This is him speaking. What can be a better source of pride than the fact that the USA, with all its military might, its boastfulness, its claims, its mass media, and its allies among puppet regimes, has been so dumbfounded and disgraced in its dealings with the dauntless Iranian nation and the land of His Holiness Baghiyatullah.
Wonderful.
That it does not know which way to turn and who to turn to. This is not the work of anyone. This is not the work of anyone or anything except divine assistance.
Divine assistance.
That has awakened nations. Islamic awakening?
Islamic awakening.
Particularly the Iranian Muslim nation, and has guided it from darkness into light, the light of Islam. And this is the final paragraph that I'm going to read. I now take this opportunity to advise the oppressed and noble nations, including our own, to stay firmly on this divine straight path that leads neither to the atheistic mulhid, God-denying East, nor to the oppressive, idolatrous West, but to the path which Almighty God has decreed for us.
Exactly.
I further advise not to be negligent even for a single moment in being grateful for this blessing. Let no polluted hand of a superpower or its agents, whether domestic or foreign, affect your determination and will. Know that the angrier the Eastern or Western satanic powers get, the more proof it is for your divine support. And God shall reward and punish the deserving ones in the best fashion, in this and in the other worlds.
Oh,
and then he quotes, finally he quotes an ayah from Surah Mu'minin, verse 88. Truly he is the Lord of all blessing, and in his land lies dominion over all things.
Well, that, in a nutshell, says everything about the greatness of the Imam in terms of the fact of the understanding of Islam, because this has been a big, big problem for many centuries. And he's given us the path, if you like, the road to salvation, and telling us that in the circumstances we are now, and we are talking about 25 years on since he said those words, and we see the situation what it is, for what it is, and everything about it still is fresh. It's still it's become crystal clear now. I mean, at that time when he was seeing those things, that wasn't clear, but now we see them, the savages for what they are, who is the real enemy of Islam. And for us, as he says, the greatest divine blessing for us is the fact that the more angrier they become with us, the better.
And, you know, I don't know. I think it really, you got to think about what he's saying. He's saying that, you know, you have to understand the nature of who they are.
Exactly.
We were
talking about that, right, in another program, that we must know our enemy.
Right. And he's talking about their terrorist state by nature.
Yeah, of course.
So
where are these human rights and all these other things they talk about?
Then he's talking about the fact that, you know, we are delighted, and it's a source of pride that they accuse us
of criminal.
And they call us names.
They call us
this
names.
This shows that
Islamophobia in Europe and whatever else you call it.
And he says the angrier that they get, and he's talking both Eastern and Western satanic powers, as he puts it.
Sure.
The more proof it is for your divine support. And this is something, you know, this is a higher...
This is Quranic, you know, this is the Quranic thinking.
And so this is the point we're trying to make with the listeners, and of course, in the first instance with ourselves.
Ourselves, yes.
You know, don't look at the minimum level of Islam.
Look at the
maximum level.
Look at the maximum, look at the ultimate.
Look at that hardcore level of it.
Hardcore.
Well, and say, oh, I don't know. Well, no, you can do it.
Yes.
You know.
It's not difficult, because the prophets themselves are our examples.
Right. So the point is that,
peace be upon,
obviously they're going to try to make you regret having gone this path.
Yes, they do, don't they?
Okay, shaitan, that's shaitan's job.
That's shaitan. He wants to make heaven look like hell.
Exactly.
And make
hell look like heaven.
Exactly.
And so the point is that, you know, I don't think we should be so worried that they call us names or terrorists or whatever, you guys are this or that. I mean, reality, everybody's seeing this now. Maybe at that time...
At that time, it wasn't clear.
Right. At that time, they were maybe able to manipulate matters more.
Sure, sure.
You know, again, the example of Syria is a very good one.
Very good. The savages are there.
Right. I mean, it's very clear who's being barbaric there.
Barbaric there, yes.
It's the Americans and the Israelis and the Saudis.
Cohorts with the Wahhabis.
Right.
Yes.
When, of course, the, you know, poodles from Europe, you know, going along.
Yeah.
And the ones who are actually fighting for unity, who are fighting to maintain, you know, peace and
stability
and civilization. Right. Because remember, barbarism is always as opposed to the civilized. Right.
Of course
you have civilized and you have barbarians.
Barbarians. That's still true since Roman days.
So, I think it's safe to say that, you know,
Iran is at the forefront of civilization.
Of civilization in this matter.
Exactly. And this is what's eating away at them at the moment because...
Because we're not... We're
no,
supposed
because
to be
I,
there.
I tell... No, I'm only going to quote from, you know, their own experts. Even, you know, Professor Neil Ferguson, who's also an Oxford economist from Oxford.
Scottish.
He's not Scottish. Yes, it is. Yes, Ferguson. He is Scottish. I beg your pardon. Sorry. Sorry, mm-hmm. Mr. Ferguson. Anyway... He says, in his own words, that you know, the West is in decline because of its paganism and its hedonism and the fact that it is corrupt beyond belief. And because of that, their decline is such that they have gone into the depths of barbarism. But they don't realize it. Until now, 25 years on, as we were talking about the occupation movement, the Occupy movement. We were looking at other protests elsewhere throughout Europe. Of course, the Islamic Awakening is on the one hand. But when we put all that together, we see the truth ringing out of the Imam's words. But that's exactly the situation that we've got now. That people have now realized that, wait a minute, these people who are professing civilization and human rights and all the rest of it are in cahoots with liberators, head choppers, who, you know, I mean, we saw that on the screens, you know, Christian priests in Syria with their heads being hacked off with a saw. Right. And they think that's okay. You tell me what the war on terror is all about.
Right. And I think the point that he's, Imam Khomeini is talking here too. He's speaking to Muslims.
He's speaking to Muslims.
He's saying to them. I mean, he says obviously he's speaking to more than Muslims, but his main audience or the main people who are supposed to understand this are the Muslims. So it's. I think we have a problem in the Muslim world is that we don't really go to the furthest extent that the Quran wants us.
Exactly. And the other
we're always trying to kind of make it sweeter and nicer and.
Yeah,
you know, let's have a whole big spoon of sugar so the medicine goes down. You know.
Yeah, exactly. But
that's not the point. The point is that you know it's not about in your heart, and this is a different issue than trying to you know deal diplomatically with your enemy or with people. That,
no, that's not what we're talking
you know,
about.
It doesn't mean that you go out and you are rude. But in your heart, okay, don't. You shouldn't care what they say about
you. Exactly. Because there is a Quranic ayat I was about to quote that the believers, the mu'mineen, are hard against the unbelievers, but compassionate amongst themselves.
Right. So, you know, I mean, I'm really impressed by what he's saying here. Yeah. When we and the oppressed peoples of the world are delighted to be the objects of criminal accusations.
Yes.
By the superpowers through their international mass media.
In a sense, I'm getting that Islamophobia thing. Aren't we?
He's like, this, you know, yeah, I mean, we're quite happy
we're
that
quite
you're
happy
doing
that
this.
You do
and,
this.
And unfortunately, I see a lot of Muslims. They're like, don't. That's not good. Whatever.
I don't want to say this, and I don't want to quote that. No, this is the point. You know, I was going to say I saw on the television this wonderful image where you see Kofi Annan, the former UN Secretary General, along with. A good friend, Desmond Tutu.
Yeah.
The Archbishop with a huge cross. I mean, I love Desmond Tutu. I mean, he really knows how to decorate himself. But he's got the huge cross right in front. And what's he doing? He's doing pilgrimage. He's doing ziyara, as we say. Of Imam Khomeini. Desmond Tutu.
That's
you see,
very good.
That's the crux of what we're talking about. You see... I tell you, I used to have these debates with non-Muslims in my office when I used to work as an engineer.
Right.
And when I used to say the nitty-gritty, which I grasped from the Holy Imam, that, look, this is the reality of things, you know. I mean, you may not know this now, but you'll realize this later.
Right.
And they didn't like what I had to say. It doesn't go down well. I used to see the colors change in the face, you know.
Right.
You, 1 minute red, next minute white, you know.
Right.
But maybe that's just the way Anglo-Saxons look. I don't know.
Right.
But anyway,
or blue,
as it happens to be in Scotland.
As Billy Connolly
said.
But
at the end of the day, you know what they said? They said, you know, you're right to stick to what you know. It's right to stick to principle. And that's the thing. This is what we're talking about here, that if we understand the reality of what we believe, we stick to principle, right, things will come our way. They'll realize that we really stand for something that's important, something that's truth. Otherwise,
I mean, I think it just goes back to, I mean, it goes back to what we've been talking about in different programs, which is, do you believe the Quran
or not? Exactly.
Okay, I mean, like you said, you know, people reciting it parrot-wise and...
Singers of the Quran,
that's, you know, we don't want that.
We don't.
We want somebody, and again, this is first addressed to ourselves, who, when they read about a promise, a divine promise in the Quran...
They believe it. Yes, because Allah said it. I believe Allah.
Okay, this is the problem. This is the problem. We want to believe, or we, you know, it makes us feel emotionally good when we hear this. Mm. But then when we're faced with these issues...
Issues, yes.
On a real...
Reality basis, right, yes.
Whether it's as an individual or whether it's as a government or as a government official.
Yes, as a government.
And then we think to ourselves, well, how is it that God could really... You know, the Americans, with all their power, they can do this and that.
That, yes.
I mean, I'm very upset because... Our dear foreign minister said something he shouldn't have said, and you know, and he did apologize afterwards.
Did he?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hadn't heard this.
He had to.
Okay.
He basically said that, you know, what are you talking about? They can destroy our, the Americans can destroy our, you know, anti-air
system, defense system,
with one bomb, and. You know, this, I think, shows a poverty of understanding.
It does.
Of what's going on. Because remember, at the time of the war...
Mm-hmm. And at the time when these... Well, I mean, I know this is the will, but I just like to go back to the desert of...
Right, exactly. I mean, you know...
Desert of Tabas. Right. Please remember that one.
The point is that...
Where the Quranic verse of Surah Fil was recited, and I remember that it went through every mosque all over the world, that what happened in the desert of Tabas was like Surah Fil. End of story.
Right. And my point is this.
Yes.
Whether you know Surah Fil or you don't.
Don't, yes.
Okay, yeah, sure. Or whether you're able to...
Sorry, I meant the chapter of the elephant.
Just right, exactly. And I'm simply saying that, you know, you have to understand that there is two schools. One is relying on divine assistance.
Exactly. Solely.
Right. And... Yep. The other school is relying on other than that, whatever that other thing is. Whether it's your own, you know, thinking that you yourself can do things, whether it's, you know, whoever is going to help you, this nation, that nation.
Well, this is where I love that in the Quran when I read that.
And these are the only two options.
Yes.
As a Muslim, right, this is my point. As a Muslim, you have to believe in divine assistance. Otherwise, you don't really understand what you're doing.
Exactly, because what I was going to say was, and this is what you see in the Quran over and over again, Allah says, do you believe me when I make my promise to you that I will reward you both in this world and in the hereafter? Or have you decided in your heart of heart that you have other gods beside me?
Right. So the point is, it's not even about rational versus irrational, because they always come back and they say, well, you got to look at things rationally.
Rationally, yes.
This is the way the world is.
Yes, practically, yes.
And the point is really this. Okay, if somebody from the beginning doesn't believe in God, yes.
Yeah, that's true.
Very rational.
Very rational.
You look at the material facts, so to speak, as they say, empirical analysis.
Yes.
And done.
Yes, you're thinking of your pocket and your stomach.
Now, the interesting thing is that empirical evidence proves that even relying on empirical evidence is not always reliable.
No, because we've got crises all over the place.
It's that thing you were talking about, which is you as an engineer, you do simulations where, hey, suddenly...
Thank you. Thank
right?
you.
I think
Why do you bring
I think,
that back
I think, to me? I think it's called Black Swan.
Yes.
It's called the Black Swan... In economics, they call it Black Swan.
It's a Black Swan, right?
Which is that, you know, an event that there was no way of predicting.
No way of predicting.
Just like, you know, it's very rare to have a Black Swan.
Oh, and it's, you know, very rare to have a 500-mile-an-hour wind, but you may get it and your bridge disappears.
Right. Yes. So the point is that even if you just, you know, there's a limit.
Yes,
doesn't mean
limit.
You shouldn't do empirical
yes.
analysis. Nobody's
yes,
against nobody's
yes.
against empirical
no,
analysis.
No,
nobody's
no.
against science.
No.
Right?
We invented it, actually.
Yeah, and remember,